Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just about 1% of all Americans who work at Walmart. So yeah, it's a big deal when they raise their minimum wage. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday. This one is the 19th of February. Good, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Here are the details from the Walmart story. The new wage, starting in April, will be at least $9 an hour. About 500,000 people, a half a million people, will see a bump in their take-home pay. Next year, at this time, it'll be 10 bucks an hour. Given Walmart's size and its long and not always smooth relationship with its labor force, this is a story with a whole lot of layers. Marketplace's David Gura gets us going with what it's going to mean to the people getting the raise.
At a Walmart supercenter in Dayton, Ohio, a part-time associate in apparel makes $8.10 an hour. That is the minimum wage in Ohio.
Right now, it's just pretty much paycheck to paycheck.
Barely enough to cover her bills, says Kelly Salee. She has been pushing Walmart to raise its wages with a group called Our Walmart when she's not stocking shelves or working in the fitting room. And she expects her hourly wage will go up by 90 cents. Salee is 22. She's engaged. She wants to start a family. And Salee says she and her fiancé already know what they'd do with more money.
We would save up for a car. We'd be able to pay car insurance.
She could stop taking the bus to work. Aaron Dubay is an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and he says Walmart's decision could make a difference, especially to employees who are making the federal minimum wage. That's $7.25 an hour.
We're talking about $1,000 or $2,000 maybe for some of the more affected workers.
Dubay says there is evidence that when minimum wage workers see their wages rise, they start saving. Amy Glassmeyer is a professor at MIT who spent a lot of time studying poverty issues and what constitutes a living wage. And she says even a modest increase matters.
A family member getting sick, a car needing a repair, a dollar's going to add up. 10% increase is a 10% increase.
But for many Walmart workers who live around the federal poverty line, that's about $12,000 a year for a single person, that increase is likely to provide only some solace. David Newmark is an economics professor at UC Irvine.
This is moving from the bottom to, a shade above the bottom.
Now, Walmart says this pay bump is significant. It's going to cost the company around $1 billion a year. And my colleague Stan Alcorn has been looking at what this will mean for the largest private employer in the U.S.
That's right. I mean, $1 billion does sound like a massive business-altering investment, to me anyways.
No, same here.
Right, but I talked to an economist at Texas Tech. His name is Michael Knoll, and he says to Walmart, with a market cap north of $250 billion, it's a drop in the bucket, and it doesn't change that it's a company fundamentally built on low costs.
Everything is inexpensive. That's their business model. That business model actually hasn't changed.
What has changed is the job market. Unemployment is falling, and as employees have more options, Walmart has to work harder and pay more to keep them.
You will see more companies do this because it is that time. The economy is improving. And when the economy improves, wages improve.
But there is something more strategic at play. Zeynep Tan, an operations professor at MIT, says higher wages will help cut down on turnover, which will mean more experienced workers stocking the shelves and talking to customers.
The result is great customer service. The result is excellence in operations. And the result is higher sales and a virtuous cycle.
That all sounds great for workers and for customers. But is it good for shareholders? David Schick, retail analyst at Stifel, thinks that depends on whether they take a long-term view.
Do the investors care more about the visibility of the next 30, 60, 90 days or the long-term? And there's a leap of faith that if you raise wages or cost to running your business, that there will be an outcome that's better for the business.
The fact that the stock price is down more than 3% today is a sign that investors are still working on that whole leap of faith thing. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
Stan told you about Walmart shares. The broader markets were more benign, despite a bit of renewed Greco-German tension over in Europe today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A couple of weeks ago, there was an interesting collision of new media and social media on the front page of one of the icons of mainstream media, the New York Times. Six crowdsourced Instagram pictures of the first of the many blizzards to hit the Northeast this winter wound up on page A1 of the Times. Kind of remarkable, considering Instagram was only founded 4.5 years ago. Of course, it does have 300 million monthly users already, which helps explain why Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, decided to buy Instagram for $1 billion a couple of years ago. The Facebook campus in Menlo Park, deep in the heart of Silicon Valley, was where I sat down with Instagram co-founder Kevin Systrom a couple of weeks ago in a room that, not surprisingly, had enlarged Instagram pictures all over the walls.
This photo was actually, we were on vacation in Mexico, and I decided that I wanted to learn how to make filters. And we took a picture of a dog at a taco stand. And had I known it was going to be the first photo on Instagram, I would have tried a little harder.
That's not even your dog?
That's not even our dog. That's a little, it's actually a stray dog in Mexico. We got to try to track it down.
You totally should. I can't believe you haven't tried to track it down yet. The Instagram we use today is a little bit like the dog in that picture, just a distant memory. Because when Kevin Systrom and his co-founder originally came up with the idea, the app was something different. So that is where I started this month's Conversation from the Corner Office. The original thing that you had going on was a check-in app, right?
That's true.
Where you could, if you wanted to, post pictures. And then at some point, a switch flipped in your brain or your co-founder, Mike Krieger's brain, and you said, wait a minute, let's make it a photo app with a check-in if you want to. Is that the basic gist? That is absolutely true.
And someone once described entrepreneurship to me as a series of happy accidents. And initially, we wanted to create a game where you checked in at places and shared where you were. You happened to be able to share a photo. But it turns out all people did was share photos. So like any good entrepreneur, we spotted an opportunity, which was sharing photos. And as soon as we kind of wrapped our head around that, we realized that could be a really powerful platform for expressing yourself, for expressing something about a product or a moment.
The day you flipped the switch and turned this thing on, what were you expecting?
Yeah, my co-founder and I had a bet. And my bet was that we'd have 2,500 users sign up. Yeah. He said 25,000. And I thought to myself, he's crazy. And of course, the first day he was right. So we grew very, very quickly from day one.
What were the stakes in that bet?
The stakes weren't much. We didn't have much. So to be clear, we were sharing a desk, you know, in a pier in San Francisco. So let's just say I bought him a beer.
I'm going to fast forward a little because there's lots to talk about. And you guys went through startup pains and all this. But then one day, Mark Zuckerberg calls and says, I want to give you $1 billion for this company you started 18 months ago. What's that like? What goes through your head when that happens?
Yeah, I've reflected a lot on the history of this company, and there are a bunch of moments that basically don't exist in company's history, period. One is the fact that we started the company with two people and on the first day had 25,000 people sign up. Then the rapid velocity with which the community grew. No other social company has grown this quickly in this way globally. So that's unprecedented. You know, I knew Mark from a long time ago. So it wasn't like one day he just called. It was an ongoing conversation.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, listen, it's a lot of money. But like why we're here is not to focus on money, but instead is to focus on building a business.
For all that you have autonomy within this company, right? That was part of the deal that you made with Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
How squeezed do you feel by not being, in essence, your own boss anymore?
It is a fallacy to think even when you are an entrepreneur that you are your own boss. You've got shareholders then, you've got venture capitalists, you've got employees. That's something every entrepreneur realizes is like you always have a boss. The great news is that my boss happens to be one of the most successful entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs in the world.
Do you guys have coffee every Tuesday at 9:15? Or I mean, how often do you see him?
He doesn't drink caffeine. So I on the other hand, I'm a caffeine addict.
Ice water. I don't know what runs through his veins.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, we meet a lot. And the awesome thing is it's like two founders meeting. Two founders that get to compare notes on how they run their companies. And I feel like I'm learning a lot. And I hope he does too.
Do you wake up in the mornings and go, I am running a cultural phenomenon?
It's funny. I don't think about it too much, but every now and then it'll pop up. So, you know,
and then are you like paralyzed? I mean, what happens?
No, it's just super, you know, gratifying. It's really meaningful to me because you'll be overseas in a bar somewhere random and you'll see people, you know, pull Instagram out on their phone and they're using it in a different language. It's just cool.
And do you tap them on the shoulder and go, hey, that I did that?
I was riding up on a chairlift this weekend, and there were two teens on the chairlift talking about how to get famous on Instagram, and I wanted to lean over and tell them how, but I decided to let it go. So.
Oh, man.
But it is surreal, and I love it.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you.
We've got more from my talk with Kevin Systrom on our website, what his personal favorite filter is, and why Instagram pictures are square. Anyway, check it out, marketplace.org. Coming up.
You'll see a lot of orange around this facility, and there are days where you go, I don't know who in the country is eating this much carrot, but there's a lot.
Billions of carrots, and they are all being grown in California. Our series, Water, the High Price of Cheap, straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go. On this Thursday, the Dow Industrial is off 0.2%, 44 points, closed at 17,985. The S&P 500 dipped 0.1%. That's 2 points, finished at 2,097. The NASDAQ continued its run, though, gained 0.3%, 18 points, ended things at 49.24. The NASDAQ can thank Priceline, among others, for giving it a boost. The stock was up nearly 8.5% after reporting better-than-expected earnings. Crude prices fell again. Oil is at $51.16 a barrel today. That touched off another slide in energy stock. Chevron drained nearly 2%. Exxon took a loss of 1.75% today. Financials down pretty much across the board. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose. 2.12% is the yield, and you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The National Governors Association winter meeting convenes in Washington, D.C. The United Nations marks World Day of Social Justice. And tomorrow is Love Your Pet Day. I know. It just kind of blends in with the other 364 days of the year. I'm sure you'll make it special. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are 20 actors nominated for Academy Awards every year, 10 each for lead parts and 10 for supporting. Every one of those nominations has a story that starts long before the cameras roll, a story that starts at a desk somewhere, often in Los Angeles, occupied by the film's casting director. Yet there will be no casting director category at the Oscars on Sunday night, even though any given picture can be a hit or a miss depending on who's in it. So for our unsung heroes of Oscar series today, Terry Taylor, she's the casting director for Whiplash, a film, by the way, nominated for Best Picture and Best Supporting Actor for J.K. Simmons. Terry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
How do you do what you do? Because it seems a very strange mix of alchemy and audience research and going with your gut and all kinds of stuff to get the right cast in a movie, huh?
We start the casting process by reading the script, obviously, and consulting with the director. And in this case, that's Damien Chazelle.
Right.
And we talk about what he sees for the film in the different roles. And then I go into my casting workshop and we start thinking about actors and we start having casting sessions and auditioning actors.
Tell me about that workshop. Do you sit down first with a pile of headshots and go, yes, no, maybe, no, no, yes, maybe, maybe?
Essentially, I mean, you know, we don't oftentimes have actual headshots anymore because everything is digital.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And so I'm looking at a lot of things on my computer. I talk with talent agents a lot. They also read the script. They have a lot of suggestions. They're usually very helpful. I have a lot of ideas of actors that I've met in the past that I know very well. I'm incredibly familiar with their work, which is a gigantic part of my job, is to educate myself on actors and what work they're doing.
Do you have to consider budget, like possible salaries and how big the cast is going to be and stuff like that?
Absolutely. That's a big part of my job.
Oh, really?
Whiplash is a low-budget film. We made it for $3 million, and it absolutely affects the casting process. You know, I think the truth is that we are limited because of our financial resources when you're making a low-budget movie. Not everybody is, you know, interested or can work for, you know, what we pay, which is in this case scale, you know, SAG scale.
Yeah.
So I think it affects our casting process 100%.
When you see the finished product, what goes through your mind?
Well, in the case of Whiplash, I was incredibly proud. I knew going in that it was a special project, but not only was the filmmaking wonderful, but the acting across the board was so good, even down to the smallest parts. We really helped Damien find even all the musicians and studio band, and it was just pride, I think, not only for the work that we had done in our craft and assembling people in every role that could get the job done, but for all of those actors, I feel like a little bit of a kind of maternal, you know, feeling for everybody that we assembled. And I was just really, really proud.
Does it bug you that you are not Oscar eligible, as it were?
I wouldn't say that it bugs me, but I am aware of it. I think we are, as a group who's integral to getting the movie to the screen, we are well aware of it, and we are doing what we can to raise awareness of our contribution, not only with the Academy, but with, you know, moviegoers and people who are movie lovers.
Yeah, but if Whiplash wins, right, you get to put that on your resume.
Yes. Even that Whiplash is nominated, it has been a really amazing ride to be a part of, and I'm really grateful for all of that. But casting directors do have their own branch at the Academy now, which is a big step for us and for our department.
Progress. Well, we'll call you in a couple of years when you're nominated for the Oscar.
That would be great.
Terry Taylor, she's casting director for Whiplash. Terry, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
Our sustainability reporters have been out this month telling stories of water, which, of course, we need to live, but which the economy needs pretty much just as much. So far, we've focused on drinking water, but here in California, as in many states, the biggest water users are farmers. Almost 80% of the water we use out here goes to agriculture. That's partly because ranchers and farmers have held on tight to water rights, rights that were handed out long before there were 38 million people here, not to mention a drought for the ages. So today on our series, Water, the High Price of Cheap, Sarah Gardner takes us to the heart of California's agriculture industry, the Central Valley.
This is the sound of California's Central Valley. This, too. And this. You've just been passed by a wave of produce trucks traveling up Interstate 5, ridden in a pickup through a muddy orange grove, and stood a little too close to a 65,000-pound carrot harvester. And you haven't even reached Fresno yet.
The Central Valley is an enormous place, first of all. It's approximately 400 miles long. It averages about 50 miles wide.
Historian Phil Garone.
If you think about that, that's larger than many states.
Between the Central Valley, some coastal areas, and the Imperial Valley on the Mexican border, California grows roughly half the fruits, nuts, and veggies Americans eat. And the Central Valley's 7 million acres of irrigated farmland are at the heart of it. It's farming on steroids. Agricultural economist Daniel Sumner says the region churns out everything from canned tomatoes to Chardonnay grapes to citrus.
Almost all the oranges, seedless mandarins in the United States come from the Central Valley of California.
Not to mention all the almonds. Want to talk about water? Almonds require a gallon of water each. Oh, and the million-plus dairy cows that live in the valley, they each drink a bathtub full of water every day. All these thirsty crops and livestock, some in counties lucky to get 8 inches of rain a year. That's what Phoenix gets. Cornell University's Andrew Novakovich.
When you think about California without water, there's not a whole lot of agricultural potential there. But like the rest of the West, and even more so in the Central Valley, you throw in a little water and it becomes an incredibly fertile, incredibly productive area.
But water is the key. Cheap water, and lots of it. A Herculean system of government-built dams, canals, and pipelines carries melted snowpack from the Sierra Nevadas on the eastern edge of the valley down to the hot, dusty flatlands below. That snowpack is at near record lows right now, and when that happens, California's first-come, first-served water rights leaves the last-served staring at a dry tap. Even in wetter years, the water supply is oversubscribed, says Phil Garone.
There literally are water rights to more acre feet of water than there is water available.
So if California's future continues to be hotter and drier, what happens to the thirsty Central Valley? Because here's the thing. California is by far the top agricultural producer in the country, but it's barely a farm state. Agriculture here accounts for only 2% of California's GDP. Jay Lund heads the Center for Watershed Sciences at the University of California, Davis.
If you're driving between cities, you'll see a lot of agriculture. But if you look at economic production per acre or per acre foot of water, agriculture is very, very small compared to most urban uses of water and land.
Lund says in a persistent drought, farming in the Central Valley would inevitably shrink. But he and other researchers wondered, what's the worst that could happen? So they computer modeled a seven-decade mega drought.
What the model does is says, well, the urban areas, they have very, very high willingness to pay for water.
The model shows water to farms and ranches shrinks 25%. Irrigated cropland in the valley plummets. Some farming communities die. The environment suffers. But farming survives. In fact, it loses just 10% of economic production.
It sounds really disastrous to lose half the water in California, and in some places it definitely would be. But the overall economy and our overall civilization really stays around.
And that's partly because it doesn't take a lot of water moving from farmers to cities to satisfy urban needs. After all, plants and livestock require a lot of water. Farmers don't talk in gallons, he says. They talk in acre feet. That's 326,000 gallons.
Think of gallon jugs filling football field after football field. And think of what we do with it. We pour it on the ground.
That mega drought model, by the way, assumes some things like efficient water trading and farmers doing what they've always done, adapt. That's already happening in the valley. They're drip irrigating fields instead of flooding them and ditching low-value crops like cotton for more lucrative crops like nuts that fetch premium prices overseas. Jay Lund.
It's a business. And so when a farmer is short on water, they're going to say, well, I'd like to have more water, but the water I have, I'm going to make the most profit from it that I can.
Which brings us back to that noisy carrot harvester you heard when we began this story. Here in the valley, carrots aren't just carrots. Bolthouse Farms is thriving on what's called value-added agriculture, like taking a run-of-the-mill vegetable and turning it into a kid's snack sensation. Bolthouse is doing that with baby carrots. They come in colorful little packets with a pouch of seasoning. Chili lime, anyone?
Seriously, why not? They're orange, they're crunchy, they're sweet, incredibly convenient. You can literally snack a vegetable anywhere, anytime.
Todd Putman is chief marketing officer for Bolthouse. If you're looking for Old McDonald's Farm, you won't find it here. Bolthouse is owned by Campbell Soup. The company's plant here in Bakersfield processes 2 billion pounds of carrots a year.
You'll see a lot of orange around this facility, and there are days where you go, I don't know who in the country is eating this much carrot, but there's a lot.
But the sheer size of the operation here, a square mile facility, 2,000 employees, reminds you that there are real people behind those numbers in Jay Lund's California computer model.
So this is our Valencia Grove, and once again, as you can see, there's hardly any fruit in it.
And we're finally back to that hiccup driving through a muddy orange grove. Michael McMaster is a third-generation farmer who grows oranges and lemons in Tulare County, just west of the Sierras. This year, he didn't receive a drop of irrigation water from the federally run water project he depends on. He lost most of his crop as a result.
And what little we have left is tiny. I mean, the fruit that's remaining is too small to market. So we're looking at pretty much a total loss for this season.
One in four jobs in this county depend on growers like McMaster staying in business. Yes, he says, the U.S. could import all its citrus, but at what cost?
We provide some of the safest produce in the world at a reasonable price. And once we're gone, it will be hard to bring it back.
This season, McMaster managed to keep his trees alive only by buying surplus water from a district with more senior water rights than his. He paid eight times his normal price, roughly what many city dwellers pay. In California's Central Valley, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
We've got a whole mess of pictures of the Central Valley farms that Sarah visited. They are on our website. Of course, it is marketplace.org. This final note today, which comes with the observation that surrender is indeed sometimes the smartest thing to do. Earlier this week, the website for the Visitors Bureau in Ithaca, New York, a city currently buried under I don't know how many feet of snow, knew enough was enough. They put a picture of the beaches of the Florida Keys on their homepage with the line, "That's it. We surrender. Winter, you win. Key West, anyone?" The site is back to normal now, but the Bureau's director said to the Ithaca Journal that it was, quote, a way to stay engaged with customers at a time when upstate New York isn't exactly top of mind. So there you go.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
The Dow off 0.2% today as we close things out. That is 44 points. The NASDAQ up 0.3%, 18 points. The S&P 500 down 0.1%. That was 2 points. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.